that the speaker does not have to apologize for talking about, or even explain why it is worthwhile listening to. Human life is such a subject, as everyone, Christian and non-Christian, believer and unbeliever, agrees. On every side today, we hear and read about successful efforts being made to prevent human life by means of contraception. Of now, the legalized practice of terminating unborn human life by direct abortion. Of proposed legal means of destroying born and unborn, as they say, defective human life, and of manipulating the production of human life in the laboratory, and of ending adult human life, which because of old age or the ravages of disease is considered a burden on the nation's economy and a liability to the nation's progress for social change. The issues at stake and the principles involved in this massive preoccupation with the improvement of human life are so deep and so far-reaching that there is danger of not seeing the forest for the trees or of getting lost in so many details which are interesting enough and not unimportant, but not at the heart of the present crisis affecting Western civilization. What is the one question that underlies all the rest? And thousands are being asked. And that for us Catholics lies at the bottom of everything else. It is this question. What is the meaning of human life according to the teaching of Catholic Christianity? Depending on how we answer this question, everything else follows. There is no more crucial question and correspondingly crucial answer that we must clearly understand if, as Christians, we are not to allow human life to be treated as just another commodity in our consumer preoccupied society. My purpose in this conference is to do three things. First, to clarify by giving the unequivocal answer of the Catholic Church that human life is meaningful because human life is sacred. Then explain the value of keeping the Church's fundamental teaching always in mind in order to intelligently defend the right to human life. And finally, deal with one growing threat to human life, casually called euthanasia, to see what the Church teaches on this form of voluntary homicide and how we should respond to the Church's expectations of the faithful, especially if we are in a position to stem the tide of what some are predicting is the forthcoming, since the legalization of abortion, national American genocide. First then, human life is sacred. There are many fine things we can say about human life, all of which are true. That human life is marvelous and stands at the apex of all visible organism around us, superior to the plants and flowers, higher than the fishes and birds of the air, and more perfect in its function and complexity than even the highest kinds of animal known to scientific zoology. Surely, human life is marvelous. That human life is precious, and that those who have it cherish this possession above everything else they own, as the medical and health professions so amply and expensively testify. But there is one quality of human life that is not quite accessible to reason, and that we as believers accept on faith. Namely, human life is not only wonderful and superior and beautiful and precious. Human life is sacred. What do we mean when we say that human life is sacred? We mean that somehow it is associated with God. That's the essence of anything sacred, somehow having to do, being related to God. That God is intimately and uniquely bound up with human life, as he is related to no other life in the visible world. In a word, human life is holy because it mysteriously and distinctively belongs to God. Something is sacred, we say, if it is not profane. That is, if it pertains to the divine, human life partakes of the divine. If we ask further how this is so, we have the answer written in the pages of Revelation and of now 2,000 years of Christian tradition. Specifically, human life is sacred on four counts, each adding to its holiness, and each succeeding reason building on the one that precedes. Human life is sacred because it comes from God, as no other life is derived from him. We believe that God enters into it at the moment of the conception of each human being by his creative power to separately and individually and repeatedly produce out of nothing. That's what creates means. By creating, then, each person's soul at the very moment of its infusion into the body, prepared for that body by the human parents. God, then, is the creative author of every single human life. It is his by creation.
Human life is sacred because, unlike all other terrestrial life, it participates in God's own immortality. Unlike God, it is begun in time, but like God, it is never to come to an end. Human life will never cease to be. It is therefore sacred because God has conferred on human life the image of His own eternity. Human life is sacred because God has endowed this life alone on earth of all living things with His own divine attribute to freely choose. As a result, man is essentially a religious being created by his Maker to use his God-given freedom to know, praise, and love his Creator, and thereby give him the voluntary service of his heart, which not even the sun, moon, and stars, for all their magnitude, can bestow. Human life is finally sacred because it is destined not for earth, but for heaven, not for creatures, but for the Creator, to possess and be possessed by the God from whose hands it originally came. In the light of this fourfold sacredness, as Catholic Christianity sees human life, does it make any difference how old a person is? 1 hour or 1 century? No. Does it make any difference what the physical condition of a person is? Whether prenatal in the womb or fully mature in adulthood? No. Does it make any difference what the mental or emotional condition of a person is? Whether an idiot or a genius? No. In a word, human life is sacred because it is human, and since it is human, as we have seen, it belongs by every possible title to God. While saying it is our life, it is distinctively also His. It is His by the primary title of its divinely created origin, no less than with the first parents of the human race. Each human being is a free gift to that human being of his loving Creator. It is His by the further title of likeness to His own endlessness. We seem to die. We don't. Man, as man, never dies. Human life, then, as divine life, is to be without end. It is His by the unspeakable title of likeness to His own sovereign liberty human life as divine life. He is free to love. Because God is God, He freely loves man whom He created. God has gifted man with the freedom to love in a way that responds to God's own measureless love for man. Human life is God's. By the predestined title of having been brought into existence in order to behold the face of God. And in that beatifying vision, satisfy all its God-given desires. So much then for the meaning of human life. Does it have meaning? Yes. And every person in his right mind admits that human life has meaning. Where we divide and now we diverge is on what that meaning is. Because depending on how we explain the meaning of life, we shall treat human life accordingly. Our second area of reflection, the value of this revealed truth. Even a moment's reflection should tell us how basic to the current concern for human life is this fact of our Christian faith, which we cannot arrive at except very dimly and very shallowly by reason alone. We believe that human life has meaning because it is sacred. Why is this fact of our faith so basic? There are many reasons. Let me just share two of these reasons with you that I consider most valuable. First, we need motives to do anything, to eat a meal, to read a paper, to do any work. And the more difficult or challenging the enterprise, the stronger and clearer must be our motives. The most important question that we can ever ask ourselves or ask anyone else is why. If this is true, and if we need correspondingly strong motives to perform things that are not easy, it will take no uncommon motivation to strengthen our wills for the combat that awaits us in our defense of human life. But for that very reason, it is imperative that we see our struggle as founded not on mere human wisdom, but on the faith that comes from God. After all, it is one thing to be against something, in this case against abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia. And by now, I suppose, I've read some 20 books and 100 or more monographs dealing with this subject. Many well-meaning and high-minded people are pro-life. In most cases, they are rather against death than pro-life. It is then something much more to be for something, namely, the protection of innocent human life at every age and stage of its longevity. Hence the importance, as I plead with pro-life groups when they ask me to speak to them, it is not enough for you to think of abortion or infanticide or euthanasia as ugly or as disgusting or unaesthetic or revolting. You must be pellucidly clear as to why life is valuable and why you are protecting innocent human life against those who are so widely, not merely threatening it, but already destroying it. Once we realize that the ground we stand on and the principles we defend are no mere construct of human wisdom, but are part of God's revelation, we are strengthened immensely for the contest and brave with a courage that is born of the faith. In the forthcoming decades, I predict it will be especially in this area of the defense of human life that those who remain faithful to God's teaching will stand firm. All others will weaken and fall away. And of course, on a clear perception of these principles of our faith rests all the church's apostolate in favor of human life. Our hospitals, welfare institutions, homes for the aged, homes for the mentally and physically retarded, I predict, will remain standing in the United States only if those who are in authority and those who are giving themselves to these works of mercy are convinced on faith that what they are working for is something sacred, because the human life which they assist or protect somehow belongs to God. That's the first reason. We need motives that are born of faith. The sacredness of human life is not perceptible except dimly to reason alone. We need the teaching of the church giving us the teachings of God. Moreover, and this is the second reason why this truth of our faith is so valuable, indeed indispensable, to say that we are defending the right to human life is by itself ambiguous. the real question is, whose right are we defending? Is it only, or even mainly, the right of the unborn child that cannot speak for itself, or the just-born physically defective, or the crippled adult bent down with old age, or the chronic invalid bedridden with pain and disease? Whose right are we defending when we talk about the right to life? Whose right? Against whom is the injustice perpetrated if innocent human life is destroyed? Well, it is all these rights, and no doubt the rights of society. But anterior to all human rights, even the right of the person whose life is being taken, first and foremost, are the rights of God, which we are defending. The rights He has over human life, which He creatively produced, which He made to His own image and likeness, and which He is preparing to join Him in heaven in the company of the Trinity. So much for the first two levels of our reflection on the fact that life is meaningful because it is sacred, and that the sacredness of human life is attainable only by faith, and that consequently, once we recognize that life is sacred because it belongs to God by every possible title, that therefore the right to life, which we are defending and should be ready to defend with our own lives, the right is first the right of God, and only then the rights of man. Euthanasia. Until a few decades ago, euthanasia, easy death, was scarcely understood even as a word, let alone discussed except in a small circle of social theorizers. People used to have to look up the word in the dictionary to find out what it means. How fast our society has moved. Some people still think of it in terms originally defined by the Euthanasia Society of America. I quote from their definition of euthanasia not too many years ago. Euthanasia is the termination of human life by painless means for the purpose of ending severe physical suffering. Hence, the corresponding synonym, mercy killing. And what we are now reading about, the right to die. But much has happened since the Euthanasia Society was organized, first in England, then in America. And those concerned with the future of society have suddenly awakened to the implications of so-called mercy killing.
This conference is continued on Side B.
These implications strike
at the most cardinal premises of Christian revelation. They affect every facet of personal and social existence and emphasize with stark clarity the need for sound Christian principles if the very foundations of our society are to remain intact. Our country was built on Christian principles. Only Christian principles will sustain it. No great insight is needed to see why such a practice as the direct killing of unwanted adults should not be encouraged in many countries, with legislation in many states in America ready for implementation once euthanasia is legalized. Science has freed man from subjection to many of the forces of nature and in large measure brought them under his control. One effect has been to give man a sense of mastery of the universe, which he never enjoyed before. This includes mastery over human life, from planning conception to determining who shall live and for how long. Another effect has been to immerse man in the satisfactions of this world, which his own genius has discovered, with corresponding indifference to whatever lies beyond the experience of man's life on earth. Couple these two effects, and you have some explanation of why such a practice as euthanasia should have come to the surface in our day, and why its proponents are so logically persuasive in defending what the faith which created civilized human culture considers murder. It is perfectly reasonable, on secularist grounds, to argue that helpless invalids, bedridden cripples, and the unproductive aged should be quietly but firmly phased out of existence. It is estimated in the first 10 years of communist China, 25 million people were legally murdered because they were no longer useful for society. Why not? They are, on the principles of secularism, useless members of society. Useless to themselves, since all they have or may have facing them is the pain and disability of the future. And useless to others, since what can they contribute to the welfare of society, which measures a person's value by his utility, to increase the physical well-being of mankind? In 1940, the Holy See was asked about the morality of euthanasia. The occasion for the question was the growing specter of legalized murders of those whom the communists and the Nazis considered undesirable. Is it permissible? Rome was asked. Upon the mandate of public authority, directly to kill those who, although they have committed no crime deserving of death, are yet, because of psychic or physical defects, unable to be useful to the nation, but rather are considered a burden to its vigor and strength. Unquote. The question. The reply was in one sentence, and to be expected. No, because it is contrary to the natural and the divine positive law. Why does Catholic Christianity condemn euthanasia? How we will have to be defending our faith very soon in this still, in many circles, academic subject. Why does the Church condemn it? Because no matter what sentimentalists or social engineers may say, it is a grave crime against justice, both human and divine. God alone has the ownership of human life. Those who practice euthanasia assume the right of ownership over life. Therefore, the sin is either murder or suicide. There is a built-in respect for human life in the biblical tradition that has created Judeo-Christian culture. Thou shalt not kill is not only a commandment of the Decalogue. It is the expression of reverence for a human person, no matter how young or old, how strong or weak, and irrespective of his physical, mental, or emotional condition. What would genocide, under the mask of euthanasia, do to this reverence for life? It would reduce it to a pious but meaningless phrase and remove it from effective influence on the morals of the people. As we have seen, implicit in the Christian value system is the realization that human life is sacred, of and by itself, apart from any profitable function it may serve as a tool or means or instrument of productivity. Human life has a value because it's human, not because it can be a means to another end. A mother who cares for her child cares in two deeply meaningful ways. She cares because she loves. And out of a mother's love, which Scripture cites to symbolize selfless dedication, she cares for the needs of the offspring of her womb. So too, a devoted son or daughter cares for an aged parent, first in the basic sense that the parent is loved, and then in the further sense that out of love, the parent is provided with whatever he or she may need. Hidden in this revealed mystery of love is the capacity of the human heart to give itself to another person for the sake of that person, to please him, and beyond him, to please God. and without thought as to what will I get out of it, or what good will it do for me. After all, what do we mean when we speak of the dignity of human life? Do we not mean that a human being is worthy, hence he has dignity of being loved, just because he is human, no matter how otherwise lacking in dignity he may seem to be? Made by God, make like to God, redeemed by the blood of the Son of God, and destined to be with God in the city on high. That's why human life has dignity. No wonder the Catholic Church, in the words of the Second Vatican Council, looks upon euthanasia, and I quote, as an infamous, harmful, and dishonorable crime to civilization and the Creator. Not only does man have inherent dignity, but God has inalienable rights. The divine lordship over human life is an article of the Catholic faith. Namely, I believe in God, creator of heaven and earth. As a creature of God, to whom man owes every element of his being, man is entrusted with the stewardship of his earthly existence. He is bound to accept the life which God gave him with its limitations and powers, to preserve this life as the first condition of his dependence on the Creator, and not deliberately curtail his time of probation on earth, during which he is to work out and thereby merit the happiness of his final destiny. Another reason why Catholicism reprobates euthanasia is founded on what may be called the principle of the total good. This postulates a belief in the total and not merely partial reality of human existence. Unless those to whom the care of human beings is confided believe that man is more than mere animal, unless they further believe that life is not limited to the short span of time between conception and the grave, and unless they believe that man participates marvelously in the very life of God, and we've got to believe this. Not a few otherwise nominal Catholics, may God forgive them, ordain priests of God, are not clear in their belief of the sacredness of human life, in the rights of God alone over the stewardship of life, and in the fact that life has more to it than this earthly span and has a higher purpose than just to be born and to die. Because inevitably, unless our faith on this is very clear, we shall be seduced by the arguments now becoming more vocal all around us. as to what is good for a person. It all depends on how you view the person. As the Catholic Church views man's earthly sojourn, it is just that. It is a pilgrimage on which he has been placed by God and during which he is to cooperate with the divine will in order to attain a greater or less share in God's infinite beatitude. The word totality is a big word and not commonly used. It is a critical word in understanding what is good for a person and therefore that his life should not be taken because continued existence would not be good. The totality of what constitutes man on the principles of the Catholic faith is not body alone, but mortal body joined with immortal spirit. It is not earthly life alone, but a continuation of that life that begins as soon as a child is conceived and bridges the moment called death into eternity. It is not even human life alone of body and soul, but human life elevated to participation in God's life because God became man in the person of Jesus Christ. So the question we must ask those who are trying to beguile us is to keep asking them, what do you mean by good? Essential to this view of totality is the value of human liberty, by which a person can freely collaborate with divine grace and thus give glory to God, although otherwise useless. But that person is not useless, because though lying in bed as a helpless invalid, he or she can still glorify God. The value then of enduring the cross by patiently accepting in oneself and in others the ravages of disease or the heavy demands of old age, and the value of loving mercy, which does not ask why, but like Christ, sacrifices self for others just because they are others, and knows that this self-oblation is pleasing to God. Who says there's no more value left? And even what, humanly speaking, may be called useless human life, it is eminently good, but only if that life is seen with the eyes of faith. Given the premise that only God has absolute mastery of human life, only He may take away what He originally conferred, whenever and under whatever circumstances He wills, ours is not mastery, but only ministry of our own lives as of the lives of others. We may not, without grave injustice to God, deliberately terminate innocent human life.
that life is his, not ours. The first qualification, then, is that the divine commandment not to kill applies to all innocent human persons, whether born or unborn. Disqualified from this commandment are those who are judged by rightful civil authority to be a grave menace to society, such as criminals, unjust aggressors from whom we may protect ourselves, and others, or the equivalent of unjust aggressors in prosecuting a just war. Assuming that a person is innocent, not only may we not deliberately take away his life, and as I come to the conclusion of this conference, listen carefully, some of the subtleties are crucial. We may not only not deliberately take away human life, our own or anyone else's. We may not even intend to do so. There is such a thing as murder by intent. That too is forbidden. That is one side of the issue. The other side is that which immediately concerns us here, the person's intention. Even in the case of innocent persons, situations can arise where there is no intention to have someone die. Just the opposite. The desire is that he or she might live. But the death of an innocent person may be permitted, in the sense of tolerated, if again, just as in the example of an individual risking his life for the common good, it is in the pursuit of a proportionally good end. Thus, a radical surgery is urgently needed to save a mother's life. A diseased organ like the uterus may be removed, although it contains a non-viable fetus, which will certainly die as an unwanted side effect of the hysterectomy. Precise words here are crucial. Something is directly intended, when it is the immediate object of a human act, when it is the specific motive for my action, it's the reason I do it, when it is the guiding purpose I have. We now shift focus from the negative prohibition that innocent human life may not be deliberately terminated to the positive injunction that man has an obligation to sustain his own life and the life of those who depend on him. It is at this point that the developments of modern science, notably of medicine, enter the picture. The discovery of vitamins, hormones, antibiotics, sulfa drugs, penicillin, of genes and chromosomes as hereditary transmitters. All of this has been discovered by men whose lives spanned the last and present centuries, and whose contribution to longevity has no parallel since the origin of man. For our purpose, the moral axiom remains that we must use ordinary means to sustain life, and that extraordinary means are not obligatory except in rare circumstances. What is changing, of course, is the range of possibilities for extending the human lifespan. In some countries, by almost 50% since the turn of the century. As a result, what used to be extraordinary may become ordinary means of maintaining life, with prospects for a longer stay on earth for a larger number of people. Christianity views this progress with approval, and the Church encourages its advancement for the service of man. But it must be, and this is a statement of the Church, it must be in the service of man in his entirety, with attention to his material needs and his intellectual, moral, and spiritual demands in the proper order. Unquote, a statement of the Church. It may not be good for the physical or emotional well-being of the person to continue living. It may be of the highest good for the spiritual welfare of that same person. And it is always good for the spiritual well-being of those who, exercising Christ's mercy, seek to sustain human life by all available human means as long as possible. In the years to come, it will be evident, in a way it is not now, how necessary is a strong faith in the mystery of human life to preserve human life on the face of the earth. It is up to us, whom God has so wondrously gifted with life, to show our gratitude by doing all we can through prayer, sacrifice, and action to safeguard the lives of other human beings according to the will of God. In doing this, we shall be giving praise to God and cooperating in that noble enterprise to which Jesus has called us, and for which, he said, he was sent into the world by the Father, that they may have life and may have it more abundantly. Please God, we shall not fail the Savior, the author of life, in this apostolate. Thank you, sisters, for your patient listening.